Welcome back to another episode of the Front Page Football Podcast. It is very early on a Friday morning. It's actually just past 7 a.m. where I am right now. And I'm joined for a special episode by FPF's Jack Toohill, who is, get this, Canberra born, based in Sydney, but covers Newcastle. There you go. That's the trifecta there, Jack.
Yeah, there's a stigma against all of my towns. Like, just like everywhere where I've lived or have any sort of association with, there's a stigma. All right.
Where are you in Sydney again?
I don't want to.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
It makes my point fall apart because I'm like sort of towards the eastern suburbs, but that's okay. Straight up, just call me out there.
Oh man. Jack, like, ever since the Rudin stigma thing is, like, just been saying that everything has
it's
a stigma
so good.
Attached
it's
to
great
it.
Content. It's 100% great content. Regardless of, like, the opinions that are flying about, it's great content. It's just good.
All right, we're in a pretty good mood, but we're probably about to talk about some morbid stuff for quite a bit. So, one thing I was going to ask you, Socceroos game last night, did you catch it? Thoughts?
I did.
Brief thoughts.
Brief thoughts. I'll give our performance a 7 out of 10. I thought we were pretty good and secure for the first probably 65-ish, 70-ish minutes. Letting Lebanon back into the game for the last 20 minutes was a bit concerning. I will say that. I think, again, we're doing a little bit better with Hrustić. I thought he was a breath of fresh air in that midfield. And I think he's going to be super important for this cycle, especially heading into a World Cup. And I think there's still some kinks to be worked out to try and get more chances in open play. But all in all, it's a win, third win in a row, and we've started qualifying well, and we'll progress to the next round, and that's the most important thing for me.
Yep, fair enough. Okay, let's start then with why we're here. So we are going to talk in depth about the Newcastle Jets and the ownership situation and a little bit about Canberra United as well. Jack obviously covers the Jets and he is born in Canberra. So he's got, I guess, a passing interest in not passing interest. A serious interest in both situations here. So we'll start with the Jets more so. So Steve Conroy comes out on, well, he is quoted. He was obviously asked at the All-Stars kind of launch by Joey Lynch on Tuesday for basically an update on a bunch of stuff to deal with Newcastle and Canberra. And he gave a lot of concerning comments about the Jets in particular. So here's a few which kind of stood out for me. So the APL has no direct say in the sale of Newcastle Jets. It's four owners in the bid. They have been in discussions for a long period of time. Then some other stuff. The Perth support showed that we shouldn't be a part of an ownership group. We shouldn't be propping up one club. We don't have the financial capacity to do this for clubs as they go through their challenges. The owners have to make a decision on how they're going to handle that. The APL is not the owner. Those four clubs have banded together. Ultimately, the decide is about whether or not they want to keep financing, and this is ultimately in their court. So those were like kind of the three main quotes which stood out to me as I was reading that. Then we had Nick Garcia. Then no more comments from the APL side. This is on Wednesday, and he said this, which was really interesting about the Newcastle sale, where he said the first thing to understand about the Jets process is everyone confuses it with the Perth process. It's completely different, right? It's a private sale of a club which is led by the club owners, and I've got some very interesting thoughts about that as well. And then the last part of this was Shane Matisk, the Jets CEO, yesterday made a statement which was about, what, five paragraphs long? And he... Yeah, didn't really say too much. It kind of felt like a lot of a regurgitation of information that, to be honest, I think a lot of people kind of already knew as well. And it was just way too short. I think if you're a fan of the Newcastle Jets, you need a lot more from your CEO, and you probably need to feel like there's a CEO in there who's actually fighting and doing absolutely everything to save the club. I'm not saying he's not, but like that statement did not fill me with this is kind of on the right path and they're doing everything. And
this juncture, 195 words is probably just not enough to satisfy Newcastle fans and then probably the wider A-League. Let's put it that way.
And then like the last kind of paragraph of that was, in the meantime, it's important that we all remain focused on doing our best to support our women's and men's teams as they give their all for this club in the balance of the ALW and ALM competitions. Just a bit tone deaf, right? Like if you're like the reality is no Newcastle Jets fan right now is going to just ignorantly support the teams for the rest of the season when there's so much uncertainty about whether this is going to continue, right? Like, and this is why I'm going to bring you in because you follow this team. And like, is that fair what I'm saying there? Because like the Jets fans, like who you talk to, must be like shaking in their boots at the moment. This is not a promising situation at all.
Yeah, it's not for the first time either in Newcastle. We know that I think Newcastle, since the inception of the A League and going back to the NSL level, have always struggled to sustain a professional football club. And I think the problem with that statement, I think there is it sort of deflects onto the fans. It's like, well, come and show up and sort of show support. And I'm sure it's not. That's not the intention of Shane Mattis. I'm sure he sort of tried and meant it as like a rallying cry. Like he wants people to just have a little bit of positivity and just, be a lot happier. I'm sure that's the intention, but that's the way it comes off. And throughout those years of unstable ownership, it's never really been the fan representation. In the inception of the NSL, KB United were once sort of the selling point of the NSL, a team that wasn't necessarily successful but was getting decent crowds. And at one season they broke the record at the time, which was getting over 10,000 fans through the gates at an average in the NSL's, I think, second season. And then you move on into the Newcastle Rosebuds era, onto the Breakers, and now we're onto this era. And it seems like it's a perpetual sort of 8-year cycle when it comes to these things in Newcastle. And I think, in my opinion, it's not necessarily the catchment and it's not necessarily the fans. I think that there's some other underlying issues that sees Newcastle. I think it's got this sort of look of a regional sort of town city when owners do come in, and when they see that, they sort of look at the infrastructure and look at it and go, oh yeah, it's okay, but it's not, like it's lacking. And I think that's one of the reasons why these ownership issues occur. But going back to what you're saying from the APL, the thing that confuses me about those statements is that, as far as I know, the APL operates as the club owners are make up the board. So I don't understand the logic to say that, oh, well, this is a private sale and the APL can't get involved. And it's like, no, you're chairing these clubs. You're the leader of these clubs. And I'm like, yeah, fair enough. If you want to give them a kick up the ass and say, get this done, right? That's a fair enough point to take. But you can't then also deflect on and say we can't get involved because it's a private sale, because you just sort of defy logic, as far as we understand it. And then you also have to look at it from a regulatory side. What kind of contingencies do the APL do have in play if this stuff happens? Because they say we can't prop up a club like we did with Perth Glory. So obviously that's out of the question, even though that four of your board members have been propping up the Jets for, 3 years now.
So
So
I don't think the APL board, like at the top, is actually made up of all the clubs. I'm not too sure. I could be wrong. Don't quote me on that.
But they're major stakeholders, right?
But no, well, that's right. That the
Yeah.
APL, every club is a major stakeholder in the APL. So it's maybe not the board level, but obviously, yeah, the APL is the clubs.
Well, they have
So
voting rights because obviously, when that grand final deal came about, we were all concerned about the voting rights of our club CEOs. So at a certain level, the APL is the A League owners. And I think that's the main difference. And that's the reason why they sectioned off. Isn't that the whole reason for the divorce, was for the A League owners to have more control over the professional leagues and the running of the professional leagues?
Yeah, and that's the thing is that this is where it's bizarre to me. So, like, first of all, I noted a quote there from Nick Garcia about the comparison between the Perth sale and the Jets sale, and this is where it's interesting because he's right. It is different because the APL were funding Perth and, you know, basically running Perth whilst they were whilst they were ownerless. Which, and I've actually asked the APL this, I haven't gotten a response yet, but how come when Martin Leigh's license was stripped back in January 2021, and the APL was obviously around then, was that just taken over by a consortium of clubs as opposed to the APL basically, you know, bankrolling it? Because like then at least from a selling standpoint, the APL would have had direct say in Newcastle's sale, as opposed to now where it seems like they're just standing back as like some kind of regulator. And that's the thing, is this other quote I mentioned before about, you know, the owners have to make a decision. This is from Conroy. The APL is not the owner, and those four clubs, you know, ultimately have to decide. And it's like, okay, so basically, we are now in a situation where Sydney FC, the Western Sydney Wanderers, Western United, and Wellington, because as we understand it, those are the four clubs that were propping up the Jets, will basically get together at some point and essentially decide whether or not they should keep the Jets alive, or say, you know what, no, fuck that. You know, we need to look after our own finances and let's sink it. And it's like, okay, so essentially, the APL, who should still be the overriding regulator of the league, because they're the governing body of the league right now, but because of this messed up structure that we have, they're apparently not in this situation, meaning in a situation like this, clubs can actually just sink each other. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
Like battleship.
maybe, yeah, pretty much. Like, maybe I'm looking at this too, you know, simplistically, and maybe there's more legalities to it than that, but it's like, that just seems bizarre to me. Like how you can have a chair of the board of the governing body, which is running the league now, to basically just stand back and say, oh, you know what, those four clubs, they need to deal with it. We can't do anything. And like maybe technically they can't do anything, but surely you can do something, if you get what I mean.
And
It's
here's another
very
thing
strange.
that is strange about this entire situation as well. I want to point out is that you've got completely different things coming out of different bodies. You've got the APL saying that, oh, well, it's a private sale, we can't get involved, just get it done, and basically just nudging them along, just like, you know, hurry up. And on the other side, you have stuff coming out from the Newcastle Herald saying that, you know, the owners, the asking price has been agreed. That meeting that you said of the consortium, the four clubs, has already happened, right? And the asking price has been agreed. Like, that's all been agreed. And FC32, which is the consortium that is standing there in wait to take over the Jets, like, they're ready to go. They just want some clear financial data from the APL. They want to know what the salary cap will be next year, right? And they want to know how much they're getting from the broadcast deal, because the broadcast deal is pro forma, which is based on hitting KPIs of viewership, and that can be reduced over time, right? That's the deal they signed when they first went to Paramount Plus. That's the deal that's in play, right? So they're waiting for this financial data, and quite rightly going, oh, we need that financial data so we can make some revenue projections, so we can know how much we have to put into this club in its first season to keep it going. And the APL is going like, oh, we just don't know that yet because of probably Canberra's status in the league. I mean, that's an extra team, you know, and obviously Newcastle's status hasn't been cleared up yet. So they don't know if it's going to be a 12 team, 13 team, 14 team comp. They don't really know. I mean, it's probably going to be 13 if the Jets stay there with it. That seems the most likely of scenarios. I still think it's 50-50 at this point. The next one is it's going to be 13 with Canberra getting sorted, or it's going to be a 12 team comp with both of them not having a team. And I don't understand how the APL can't give them, all right, well, if it's 13 teams, this is what you get. And if Canberra gets sorted, this is what you get. So they can just make some revenue projections and know how much there, because it just doesn't make sense how you can have an asking price, you know, from what we know from the Newcastle Herald and what's been put out there by James Gardner, right? It just defies logic that there's an asking price agreed. Like, that's not the issue. The asking price has been done. Like, it's sort of like sewn up, which for a long time, that's what, you know, the fans are led to believe, that, you know, an asking price was net just not being agreed upon. And then FC32 just cut, you know, pretty much coming to James Garner and saying, look, we just don't have clarity about these two pretty important financial markers of
Do
the health of the league.
you think Conroy, Stephen Conroy, on Tuesday dismissed that report, and he said that it was basically the FC32, the consortium, you know, trying to gain leverage through through the newspapers. Leverage through the newspapers is a quote that he used. Here's the problem for Stephen Conroy in the APL.
So who's
Whenever,
where's it
no,
right then? Yeah.
Well, that's the thing is that, but they have no credibility anymore. Like this is no one actually believes anything that the APL says. This is the problem, right? Like it's, and no, whether you think that's right or wrong, this is not what I'm arguing. What I'm saying is this is the sentiment because of what's happened over these last, 3-4 years. And like, so when the Newcastle Herald reports that up against Stephen Conroy dismissing that, most people are going to lean towards the other side of the APL at the moment because that's what's being created. Now, we don't know. We haven't done our own, investigation of this. We don't know.
Unfortunately, we're not behind the doors. We don't have any access to this.
No, no, no.
It's a private sale and we cannot interfere.
Yeah, like the APL. so, yeah, that's an issue for them too. And yeah, I don't really understand this idea that the body running the lead can just sit there, watch a club, potentially sink, and at the behest of other clubs as well.
In such a key market as well, like
yeah, but the other thing is here is it's like okay, so if you're not going to be like involved in this process or the Canberra process, which I think they're a little bit more involved in, but really is still with when she Nick Garcia is to be believed. He kind of seemed to suggest that really that's still the ball is still in the court of the people in charge of the bid, essentially, trying to find an owner and stuff. And it just kind of makes me think like, what actually is your role? Like we know in the basic form what their role is, but like, if you're not going to be heavily involved in these processes, like, so what are you doing? Just making the odd, preemptive announcement about something and pissing away $40 million on an app. Like, I don't like it's starting to become very unclear.
Is a yeah. scenario that actually got some, there was some discussion on Twitter and Simon Hill, like, Channel 10 broadcaster did have some say in this conversation. So the old way that these things would happen after under the FA's supervision, right? And this is how it happened before when Tinkler, basically got the club into so much debt, along with the Newcastle Knights. That's what happened there. Like both clubs in trouble because he owned both of the Newcastle sports teams. Basically, what the FA had done was, all right, the license is gone. They rescinded the license. The license ceased, but the Pty Limited of the Newcastle Jets, their assets were still viable. So what happened in the transition was that stuff was put on the market and the sale was monitored by Football Australia, right? And then Ledman Group came in. They bought the remnants of the Newcastle Jets, the colors, the emblem. And what the FA did is award a brand new license, right? The license changed. You didn't sell a license. There was no exchange of that particular asset, right? So my, and you can say that, oh, that's a bit open shut doors. You can say it, it only secures ownership for a short amount of time and that stuff. And I can hear all those arguments, but I just want to, like, what kind of contingencies do the APL have? Like, FA at least had a contingency that did work. Like, it worked twice for the Newcastle Jets to keep them going, and it's turned the Newcastle Jets into a 20-something year institution. Like, if you count the years before the, in the NSL. So I just want to know, and this is the really frustrating thing, is the severe lack of clarity. And I bring that up again from all parties. It's frustrating to be, obviously we do media stuff. It's frustrating enough for us because we can't, get clear direction and we can't get, articles with proper information there. But it's also severely frustrating for fans to sit there and sort of get different mixed messages and, almost empty rhetoric about this process when they're facing the fact that their club might not exist in, the best part of what, 2 months? I mean, the season ends at the end of April. And I doubt, if the APL is thinking about launching the next season, I know it's a pretty long off season, but, they'd want to get that sewn up. So, you've got a matter of, maybe 6 weeks until their club goes extinct. And this is what you're delivering. It's just simply not good enough. Like, you know, this is where the mix between, you know, private ownership of sports teams, especially, and community engagement, this is where the disconnect happens, because I don't think people understand that. Yeah, like everyone understands finances. Like everyone understands capitalism. All right. We exist in it. We live in it. We balance budgets at home. All right. We know what it is to, like, oh, we cannot afford this. We can afford this. All right. We're not dumb. We're not stupid. We understand that. The problem
Unless
is.
you still live with your parents, which means that your budget control is solely down to them. Anyway.
Yes. Anyway, most people understand these philosophies, all right? Because we exist in a capitalist society, we're trained to, right? But then what they don't understand is you're also holding a community asset, all right? It's like, you know, it's not like a, you know, investment property. It's a public pool. It's a school. Like you're holding a community asset, which people, you know, use, you know, as a way to perpetuate their own identity. And that's why the rhetoric, that's why clarity is super, super important in these processes. That's why fans are becoming so apathetic towards the process. That's why you get 4,000 people at McDonald Jones Stadium, because when they turn up, all they feel is this apathy, because they're just like, oh, well, we're just rudderless and no one's telling us anything. And why would I show up? The Jets, mind you, have a membership of 7,500 people, right? So it's not your casual Newcastle fan that's not coming back. It's your members that are rejecting this process. And that is a super important marker of how you are doing in, you know, voicing fans' concerns and listening to fans' concerns.
How do you see this playing out then? Because I, in the Shane Mattis statement yesterday, he said in there that, he says the sale process will be completed soon, something along those lines. But maybe it's just something that he's chucking out there because, you got to give a dog a bone, right? But how do you think it could end up?
I would say I'm inclined to go 70-30. 70% the Jets, you know, get this wrapped up, and 30% the Jets sink. I think that there is some huge, huge ramifications. I listened to Simon Hill and Andy Harper in their short little bite-size discussion, you know, 6-minute discussion on Ten Sport that was released yesterday. And Andy Harper didn't make the point that it's a cradle of a game. And Simon Hill agreed, it's a cradle of the game. The history of football in Newcastle is long, all right, and it is sturdy. The history of football people in Newcastle is long and sturdy. Then you have to look back into the past to see the players who have come out of that era, you know, players like Craig Johnson, players like Larry Bartz, all right, who have come out of this area and who have, you know, made a name, especially in the early years of the, you know, the Socceroos and their rise, right? And you also just cut off the biggest player base in the country. You know, the Jets are the talent sort of mouth of the northern New South Wales, which goes right up to the Riverina on the border of, you know, right up north to, you know, places like Ballina, Lismore, Port Macquarie. I mean, you know, one of their players that was there for many years is called the Port Macquarie Belly, Nagus Thurgate, right? And it's like, you know, you've got these players, they do produce talent, and they do. There's been a lot of Newcastle Novocatchians who have played in the A Leagues, and there's been a lot of people from the northern New South Wales areas that have played in the A Leagues and then for the national team as well. You also have to look at from the women's team perspective, because that's very important, because so much talent. And so much current talent comes out of Newcastle. You only have to
And that
look
and they've been flying, like, well, flying in terms of
where the club's at.
yeah,
Where the
that's
club's
right.
at.
Like, that's a team that can make the finals, right?
Well, they
So
got a big game tomorrow against Melbourne Victory, and
Victory, yeah.
that'll be a big marker to see if they can make that top six. But again, relative to where the club is and relative to what's going on behind closed doors, they've had a superb season, right? And a lot of the talent in that team has come through the Newcastle ranks. And then you look at, you know, young Matildas, you know, the players that play at Newcastle that have, you know, contributed at, you know, underage international level, you know, players like Lara Gooch. And then you look at, you know, the players like Kirstie Fenton, who's now at Sydney FC, but she came through the Newcastle ranks, and she's, in my opinion, will be chomping at the bit for Matilda's selection in the coming years if she stays out of injury.
This is interesting. You mentioned that she's actually just done an ACL, obviously.
That's why I mentioned it. And then, of course, probably Newcastle's, I mean, maybe Salisbury can have similar claim to this, but Emily van Egmond, who deputized for Sam Kerr just recently at the Home World Cup, 23 Women's World Cup. And then you've got players like Salisbury, in the past who have played in Newcastle colours in the W League. So you've got a club that has contributed tremendously to the talent pools of Australian football. You've got a club that's in its ethos, and when it does have the money, the clear direction is to get talent from the area, right? Before, money was tight. We had Daniel McBreen on our podcast, and he was saying before, the money sort of stopped this happening. It was most important. The most important part of the Newcastle Jets was the emerging Jets Academy.
Well, he's been also questioning on Twitter and stuff about the academy. Like you're talking about, because if I'm not mistaken, I'm actually going to get it up in front of me as we talk. But basically, to do with what's going to happen to the academy, essentially. Right? I think that's what he was talking about. Let
Well,
me.
I think I know the tweet you're referring to. And as far as I know, the Emerging Jets, which is the foundation. So
That's right.
basically,
Yeah.
the Emerging
Foundation.
Jets, the Boys and Girls Academy, is a foundation which the Jets are the main benefactors to. And like, if the Jets go under, that effectively stops because it's not a Northern New South Wales football academy. It's not a state-based, because obviously those state-based academies stopped getting funding in replacement of the A-League academies getting set up in what, 2016? That big plan for the new curriculum that was being rolled out by Football Australia. So again, you've got that, and you have to come to terms with that. And yeah, Newcastle, people live in Newcastle. Yeah, you can just go an hour south to Central Coast Mariners, 2 hours Sydney. What about people from Port Macquarie, Coffs Harbour? What about people right up in Ballina, Lismore? Who's going to go and scout them? Who's going to go watch them play? And that's my main concern. My main concern is that there's going to be thousands and thousands of kids, young players who are talented athletes and deserve to be playing at a higher level, automatically rejected because of their locale. Let's make no mistake, whilst the capital city clubs are probably the clubs that keep the league going and are the foundation and bedrock of the A leagues, it's the regional representation, the Central Coast Mariners and the Newcastle Jets, that floods talent pools.
And because Daniel McBreen, now I've got in front of me, he basically questioned would Northern New South Wales football essentially, be the entity to kind of keep that academy going? What do you think of that? Would that
Well, I
be,
think that's a good contingency to have. I think, Northern New South Wales football has a history in that. There was Northern, I think Northern New South Wales football had an academy, and there was also the Macquarie Football Academy, which sort of serviced mostly the Lake Macquarie area and further to the West Lakes, places like Toronto, Turralba, that sort of area. And then you had Northern New South Wales putting them their own teams. They still do have representative teams that are selected to play against Football New South Wales and other representative teams as well. So that process is still ongoing. The issue is trying to get those kids into A-League clubs. That's the thing I'm concerned about, because you have, first off, one less A-League club. That's not beneficial to anyone, right? Because that means one less opportunity or field for opportunity. And then you've also got to get, most likely the clubs from Sydney to come have a look at you. And unfortunately, given the history of the Western Sydney Wanderers and Sydney FC, they haven't been inclined to be giving their academy players a lot of game time, because they're usually the clubs that go out and try to sign players to win, and that's embedded in their club. I mean, it's starting to change, I think, within Sydney FC, which is good, and I think Western Sydney Wanderers have a great pool of talent currently in the NPL squad. I've been watching them at an NPL level, so I'm inclined to say that that will change. But again, you just cut out a whole entity that focuses on that. And if you just look at Newcastle's history, you know, trying to get Novakastrian's opportunity at a professional level has always been a big part of that.
All right. I'm cautious of the time. So Canberra and this situation as well. So seems from the outside like this is in a bit of a better spot maybe than Newcastle. Because Nick Garcia in his comments on Wednesday seemed to basically suggest it's kind of there's a few things that need to be ironed out. But again, you know, I go back to just the believability of the APL. Like, you know, how much trust do I have in that really? I don't know. And then it was Luke Doherty actually on Fox Sports News. This I believe it was yesterday. Who came out with a report which said that he said that there's minor details that are close to being finalized for the awarding of the license. So, look, maybe this one's in a better spot. I don't know. But how are you seeing that situation? Because I had Paletti on here last week on Wednesday, and we spoke about Michelle Hayman's comments recently about, and that was the other thing about the player perspective. And just to quickly go back to the Newcastle situation, we had the PFA come out through the Newcastle Herald and saying that it would be incomprehensible for one of the A-League's foundation clubs to fold. So they've got that support on that side. The PFA, I don't believe, have made any sort of statement in regards to the Canberra situation, but I think Michelle Hayman maybe did it for them. But point is, there's a lack of clarity in this situation as well, where there's radio silence from Canberra United as a club. I guess they can't say too much, all right. But Capital Football haven't really said much either. There was a report yesterday I saw in the Canberra Times, which said that. Yeah, basically, Capital Football admits that rising costs are forcing them to reconsider the future of Canberra United. And from what I understand, that's had a whole bunch of issues in itself, Capital Football, in the last you know 12 months or so with management changes and all this sort of stuff. So this one this one seems like it's a little bit better, but when you dig deeper into it, I don't know. There's some issues obviously there too. How you seeing the Canberra situation?
I don't see it as any better than Newcastle's. I would say they're equally
Okay,
diabolical, to be honest. I think certainly the Canberra is much more concerning, given that you know, Capital Football were starting to flag that they might not be able to continue with Canberra United before the Canberra expansion was announced, that there was rumors flying it about. But you know, all I can say again is that Canberra United, their sort of how they've set up their club is to funnel youth into the then W League and now A League Women's, and you know, from that perspective, it is a concern. You know, I've been as a Jets fan and a Jets member as well, I've been getting statements that have been saying, "Oh, we're ironing out the final details of the ownership for the best part of a couple of months." So I'm inclined to say that those statements are not necessarily false, but can be misleading at times. So, look, all I can say is that I think that Canberra, you know, they've had a history, certainly in the A-League era. I mean, you know, being one of the big proponents of the women's division, you know, of course, having a lot of talent coming through their doors over, you know, really the last decade or so. I think that it will be equally inconsequential. Well, I cannot say that word, eh?
Inconsequential, inconsequential.
That's
Yeah,
the word.
that's
I
the
cannot
word.
say it. For Canberra United to fold just as a women's team. I mean, my concern right now is if they can't get a men's team up and running by this year, that's fine. Just don't do it. Don't do it if you can't get it done. Don't force the issue, but keep Canberra United
Well,
in
that
the
yeah, that was
you have
a
to.
yeah, I think that was in a Canberra Times report too, which said that maybe the ownership group will come in and run Canberra United for 1 year, just as a sole women's team, and then come 25, 26, so the season
Yeah, I
after.
mean, I
Then,
think
I mean, that would be
that's
more logical. I mean, here's the other thing, Jack. How about unless you got an absolute billionaire like Bill Foley, like maybe don't expand your league until you make sure like a couple of clubs are actually Stable? I don't know.
I would say maybe I don't know. Say that we want to maybe add two teams and then see if bidders come to the table before announcing stuff. Like I again.
Or maybe get some interest peaked before you kind of announce that, oh yeah, like they're going to be two licenses, or with the Canberra license, because like there's always been interest in Canberra, but it seems to me like they kind of jumped the gun on, oh, like Canberra and Auckland, they're coming in like next season, definitely don't worry about it. And
They've
then
already
like
flagged Tasmania somehow.
yeah, like Jesus Christ. You know what I mean? Like, what are they going to like flag my suburb in a minute for like an area of expansion? Like, I don't.
That's it. All of a sudden, they're going to start flagging, Dubbo United coming into the league next year, and then they're just going to keep perpetuating it. Like, choose the.
Goulburn Valley. I don't know. just random areas of Australia that I'm just
We need that country
broom.
representation. Get the Bathurst 98. Is it 58? What is it? I don't know what it is. Get the Bathurst in there. Get the Bathurst in there.
You mean the Bathurst 500? No.
No. That's the Bathurst 1000, brother.
Oh no, it's 1,000. Jesus Christ. This is my knowledge of other sports.
Newcastle 500. Thank you very much. Yes.
Okay. Oh, the Adelaide 500. That's why I'm getting that confused. Right.
Oh, Jesus.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, it was the motorsport podcast.
Anyway, what's that? They're expanding the Kangaroo Island? No.
Go to the Cook Islands. Yeah, where's the Pacific representation? Why aren't we competing for that, big bid up there? Maybe Albo give us some money.
Oh man, the Port Moresby magic. Yeah, there you go. There's an
Magic.
expansion club.
There we go. It's just like, get us a seat at the table, honestly. We're just coming up with absolute golden ideas here. But just to bring it back, I think that what you suggested in that whoever's coming on board with Canberra United, I mean, if they're saying it's in the final stages, I'm hoping they're not saying that, oh no, we're just writing the underlying, stuff of what the license means and we haven't found anyone. But I don't think that's the case.
No.
I hope not. I severely hope not. But
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty decent strategy. I mean, if they're, you've only got what, 5-ish months? Four and a half, 5-ish months to prepare a men's team, to enter the competition, which isn't a lot of time to scout players, to get sponsors, to make sure you have
Well, I
contracts in
said this
place.
already that Auckland are, working around the clock to make sure they're ready
And
already, and
they
it's
came
like
into the fray,
months
at the
ago.
turn of December, right? December-ish. So like, I think that it's a, if they are willing to come in, just say we'll bankroll Canberra United, just like retain players, bankroll Canberra United, renew whatever sort of lease they have on MacKellar Park, just operate there, start building from there, and then expand into the men's game beyond your women's team. I also think that that's an excellent option to build and retain the fan base of Canberra United, because unlike every other A-League club, they are established as a women's team first. And I think it's very important to make that distinction. And I think it would be very important to the fans of that club and the people of Canberra to acknowledge that, hey, the men's team isn't the main attraction at this point. The main attraction is the women's team, and as it should, with players like, Milivojevic and Michelle Heyman. I mean,
Matilda.
some, yeah, exactly. And Matilda, who's gone on an absolute rort at international level recently. So,
Like who most young girls around the country probably know or well aware of, like,
And aspire to be. And I think it's only proper for, if there is owners and that, if they are lined up, they fund the women's team as a priority over building their men's team. I think that has to be an underwrite of this license that they're handing out.
And it seems like we've got this FC 32 consortium with Newcastle who are there, but we don't know like who's kind of delaying that and what's really going on there. And then you've got, well, if Newcastle Herald was to be believed, it's the APL. And then you've got the Canberra situation where like you'd think there's a couple of consortium or maybe one consortium there that they're trying to, iron out the details with. So in like if you reduce it to just that, oh, there's interested parties, it's close, like, surely both will be all right. But I don't know. I just don't really trust A, the information, and B, the whether, both kind of deals are really going to get over the line and secured. So you think 70-30 you said on Newcastle, right?
Yep.
Canberra.
I think that Canberra United as a women's team will not go under. I think that it's imperative that that women's team stays. Does a men's team enter the competition in 2024-25? I would say I'm leaning towards more 50-50. I feel like there's still time, not a lot of time though. It's starting to get like if you were to enter a men's team, like you're scouting the NPL, like you don't have time to go get marquees. You're just like plucking players out of the NPL. You're probably getting the spoon in your first season and you're restarting in 25, 26. I think that if whatever owners are lined up for this license, I think that even as a business model to just fund the women's team for a year, build, over, 14, 15 month period into a men's side and grow into the men's game through the women's. Through the women's team, which is the priority and is the main attraction in Canberra, as like right now it is the main attraction and is what football people go to watch, especially from an A-League's perspective, then I think that is an excellent strategy. And we'll have to wait and see on that. There's not a lot of information out there on the Canberra deal. All we can really trust is what's coming from the APL. But like you said, it's very hard to trust them with what's gone on in recent years.
Okay, to finish, because I'm wary of the time, we had a comment, a listener comment, I guess, something for us to discuss on the pod from Blaine Treadgold, who is the Football Supporters Association of Australia's secretary, and he actually tweeted this to Jack, and he said, "The easy come, easy go ownership model of the A-League is one of its major flaws. Clubs either exist or they don't. There is no allowance given for clubs to find their level of standard and sustainability. There's never been a greater argument to open up the pyramid." I'm just going to throw to you. Thoughts on that paragraph?
Look, I think, as a fan, an open period pyramid for me, and as a fan, and also just a football person, open pyramid, has to be the end goal. And I think that, the best leagues in the world have an open pyramid. Even the development leagues out there, most of them have an open pyramid. And I think it's really, really important for football development because it allows for organic, merit-based progression of both players and club, and I think that's an important point. The argument's already there for promotion relegation being introduced at an Australian footballing level. I don't know how much it will affect football club ownership in Australia. And not to say that promotion relegation isn't a good idea for the Australian footballing family. I think that it's a very, very important thing and should be the target over the next decade, 10, 15 years. I mean, if the FA is going to release a 10-year plan, I feel like getting promotion relegation up and started should be a part of that. That was flagged a few weeks ago by our disruptor Ernie Merrick, but
Oh, yeah, that was a technical plan. So I don't know if that is all encompassing in terms of promotion relegation. Maybe that was
okay,
more like in terms of.
maybe I misspoke there. I was trying to just, have a little nudge there. But back to what, Blaine was saying. I mean, I don't think promotion relegation is silver bullet for these issues. It's a structural. It's not just a structural problem with football in Australia. It's a structural problem within sport in Australia. And we could make this into an entire podcast. The commercial market is mostly held by the NRL and AFL, let's be real, especially when it comes to footballing codes, when it comes to stadium ownership, when it comes to people who have the pro are high on the priority list when it comes to stadium leasing, even if the stadium is owned by the public, right? I think that more important to promotion relegation to provide a sustainable ecosystem for clubs to not have a in and out sort of model is to do with the infrastructure that underlies it. I would say that having A-League clubs owning stadiums and owning training parks and taking ownership over its infrastructure is the first step.
I totally agree.
And then the second step, promotion relegation, like you said, organically allows for clubs to find where they're most sustainable and the sustainable levels. I think that you need to have the infrastructure in place before you have promotion relegation, because without that, you've got an influx of clubs. And I don't think it prevents these issues from coming, bringing their ugly head again. I mean, you've seen it in England. You know, of course, the Premier League. You know, most of the Premier League club ownership is well and truly sewn up. But towards the bottom of the Championship, then leeching into League One and League Two. I mean, you always have clubs that become financially unviable and are relegated 5 tiers, and it happens a lot. Like it happens, you know, at least a club every couple of seasons, and I would like to say at a higher frequency than the A-Leagues to disbelief of people naysayers of the A-League. So, you know, an integrated pyramid is an excellent idea, and it has to be something that we need to strive to achieve. But
Well, because it's survival of the fittest, right? Like that's the argument for opening up the pyramid. And like, so I feel like the argument against that sometimes is, oh, well, like what if, like what's going to happen if, Melbourne Victory hit some financial trouble and all of a sudden they can't, like, this is one of our, staple clubs of the league, of the country. And then all of a sudden they're in the second division or something and they're financially in big trouble, like et cetera, et cetera. But it's like, yeah, okay, but if you're incompetent, like you just have to be punished for that. Like, and there's kind of that too, right? So it's like how we talk about promotion relegation in terms of on the pitch, how there's no punishments if you lose and stuff like that. But it should be the same for, off the pitch too. Like if you're financially mismanaged, if you're, not bringing in the, I don't know, commercial revenue that you need to, you're not attracting people to your stadium, to games, etc. Like you should be held accountable through the pyramid, right? So that's kind of the argument that I'm making, and I guess a lot of people just worry about like, oh, but that fan base is now going to all leave and stuff. Like I'm sure if Melbourne Victory, if the pyramid opened up, so Melbourne Victory, Sydney FC, whoever it might be. It sounds like I'm just picking on Melbourne Victory. No, I don't mean that. If they were to get relegated or something, yeah, they would obviously take a hit with their fan base and stuff like that. But if they were to get promoted again, I'm sure those fans would return. Like you
I
would think,
think it
like.
also leads to a more diverse diaspora fan as well, because you have obviously, you know, football people, you know, sitting in Amy Park every week as Victory members who are also involved in different clubs that could be clubs in a national second division that are getting promoted. So, yeah, they're, from that perspective, no, it doesn't affect it. I just think that you can't have the flow of clubs up and down without infrastructure in place, all right? Because the National Second Division and how it's being set up is, you know, I'm inclined to believe it won't be fully professional, at least not in its first season, right? That's how I'm interpreting what's coming out of this second division, which is supposed to kick off next year, by the way. And it's not going to be on the same calendar as the A-Leagues. Right. So there's another thing there, at least not in its first season. There are plans to then normalize the calendar to basically entice promotion relegation.
Yeah, which we don't talk about enough, which is actually quite ridiculous when you think about it. But anyway, yeah.
I mean, like there are plans to then slowly integrate it into the A-League's calendar and then get promotion relegation between the first and second division, and then sell licenses at a second division level instead of at a first division level anymore. Like to cease the way the A-League operates in that regard. Again, Blaine makes a terrific point. It does allow for organic sanction, especially at a financial level. I just don't think we have the infrastructure in place yet. I mean, it's an excellent argument for that to happen, but that's a 10-year process. That's not saving the Jets in the next 3 months. And it's not saving Canberra United from possibly facing issues if their owner can't support the Women's League, which I think has to be the priority in that deal. I really hope it's being done that way, but it is an excellent question, and it probably deserves a whole podcast.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, like as yeah, that whole other debate around A-League ownership and stuff, yeah, can definitely have its own 2-hour podcast for sure. But We only have time for about 50 or so minutes. So, Jack, we're going to wrap up because you need to go to work.
Go to my
And
day job.
yeah, and I feel like I'm starting to drone on. Okay. Front Page Football, make sure you're following us, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We've had a bunch of stories actually go out this week. We had an interview with Daniel Benny go out. We had a preview for Australia's other national teams go out early this week. So like the Olyroos, who've got a big month ahead of them, the Junior Matildas trying to make the World Cup, the Futsal-roos, if you're into that as well. So all that stuff. And then we also had a story which has gone out today on Pega Sports, which is a player created merchandise company here in South Australia, where I am, who do a lot of work with the local NPL clubs. It's quite an interesting story, particularly if you're from SA. So I just thought I'd plug a few stories there. Chuck us a follow on our social media. Follow us on here, Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening to it. And like we did at the end there, we had a listener comment from Blaine. If you do have any comments, queries, concerns, questions that you have for me to discuss on future pod with whoever guest I might have, or if it's just me, then I'm happy to discuss them as well. Jack, any closing remarks before we finish up?
I think it's important. I just wanted to echo something that came out this week. Ben Homer, who many people will know as a Channel 10 sport personality, commentating in both A-League men's and A-League women's,
Good commentator.
a fantastic commentator, fantastic young commentator, put out on his Instagram, I believe, a video, a really good call to arms, and basically said, look, he validated fans' ultimate concerns, but it's something I want to echo on this pod. For Newcastle people, we have a strong sporting mindset, strong sporting merit, and if the Jets are to survive, show that it should just survive, because we have an excellent membership, excellent supporters, a fantastic catchment of rich football history, and ultimately, I think one of the most unique game day experiences in the A Leagues, men or women. So there's an A League women's match at number two sports ground this week. Pack it out. Just, if it is the last ride, just enjoy every single minute with your family and friends. Enjoy being a part of something that's, for your community.
Wait, now you sound like Shane Matisse.
This is a, this is, I'm not coming from a CEO who's like, oh, just support us this season. I'm saying, like, regardless of if it's a 4-0 loss or a 1-0 victory, just enjoy the moments with the people that you've associated with that club, with your friends and family, because at the end of the day, that's what important, that's what football's about. It's about interaction. It's about building relationships. It's about being a part of something that's much larger than yourself. So it's several home games. You've got an A-League women's game. Just go and try to enjoy yourself. And, if this stuff gets sorted out, great. If it doesn't get sorted out, it's going to be tough. But, at the end of the day, you can say that, I was there when it mattered.
Morbid Pod finished with a inspirational, motivational message
Oh,
from
I
Jack.
forgot to say, Dale.
Sorry, I forgot. We need the Pitbull reference.
just quickly.
Yeah, just quickly, just quietly. All right. We're gonna wrap it up. I've been your host, Christian Marchetti. Thanks for joining us on the Friday pod. I plan to be back on Monday. I don't know right now what I'm going to talk about because the A-League is not on this weekend, but the Dub is, so maybe I'll watch some Dub games and maybe I'll do some stuff on the Dub. I don't know. We'll see how we go. And then we've got the Socceroos game Tuesday night, so probably the Wednesday pod we'll talk about that as well. There's a bunch of stuff going on. There's always stuff going on in the A-League. So thank you, Jack, and thanks for listening, and until next time, it's bye for now.